I forget. So here we are. We're starting the first lecture of Language and Meaning, and we're looking at the origins of language. And this is it's not a typical lecture. It's not so much about what language is. It's more about where it came from. In a way, this reading was Maturana. Humberto Maturana is a Chilean biologist, and Gerda Werdensöller is a German child psychologist, and they've got together to create something I think quite unique. This isn't like Maturana's usual writing, Werdensöller, there's nothing else she's written in English for me to kind of assess where she's come from, but I can kind of assess her influence on this by reading what Maturana's written. So she's had a dramatic influence. So when you're reading this, in a way, it's a collaboration between a man and a woman, and I think you might hear it if you've done the reading, I'm a bit of a school teacher. If you've done the reading, no, it's the first week. Not doing the reading's okay. Second week, you all know the score, right? Yeah. But just so you're aware, Maturana is a very significant figure in the world of biology and modern science, and particularly systems science. I feel I need to give you a little bit of background about what systems science is, and about Maturana, which is almost background from the course you didn't do on science. So we live in a culture where I think a lot of people aren't scientifically educated, and so if you were to ask them about, well, what's the scientific method, what is science, what's your understanding of physics, of biology, of chemistry, you'd get some very poor answers. You'd get a whole range of answers, but I think you'd find very few people have actually deliberately looked into this. So you'd say, well, if science doesn't seem to have much influence on the general population. Whereas my interest here as a phenomenologist is that science deeply informs our understanding of being, because it's science and technology that have shaped our world. So whether you're conscious of it or not, there's an underlying kind of inheritance of ideas that you're not explicitly aware of, but are just there in the way that we live together, in the very structure of the way that we live together, in the way that our society is organised. And in many ways, you could say that our form of economic organisation and our form of science are like closely entwined. I think only... because our science is essentially materialistic. I have to pause, because you have to use words correctly. You know, this is language. So when I'm talking about science, I'm meaning science in this sense of how it operates in our collective psyches, not science as in terms of what quantum physics is today, or what systems biology is today. So you could, at the frontiers of science, there are some very advanced ideas that just haven't percolated down, and they haven't really informed our culture. Our culture is still, in certain senses, as far as I understand it, is still in the 17th century. The general understanding of people of science, and that and the general way that we understand the world is still, you know, we're still Newtonian in many ways. You know, you know that Newtonian physics was kind of shattered by Einstein. Yes.
Igual que happening de sociology. The sociology no es posible union de phenomenology with the technology.
Yes.
Sociology interpretation.
So I mean, with sociology, again, I don't. We're not going to go into sociology as a discipline.
Mm-hmm.
But my the level I'm talking about here, I would say we're looking at social relations, in terms of how that they've been affected by technology.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure what you're asking in terms of...
Yes, between the phenomenology and the technology.
Yes.
You say it had any relation between phenomenology and the technology. I only want understand the sociology possible create this union between the phenomenology and the technology.
So, the connection between phenomenology and technology is... if I'm going to point you to something, it would be Heidegger's essay on the question concerning technology.
Mm-hmm.
So Heidegger's understanding of technology, which to an extent I share,
mm-hmm.
is that it embodies a certain understanding of being. And that understanding of being, when Heidegger was writing, he expressed it that everything on earth has become a resource, something to be used and exploited. And that basic attitude was in science to begin with. But subsequently, I was at a Heidegger workshop and somebody said something very informing to me, that in a way, even since Heidegger wrote that, for us now, everything has become an option. The whole earth for us is becoming a kind of something that we can choose on the internet.
Depends on who us is.
Yes. When I'm saying us,
talking about welfare.
When I say about us, I mean in the developed West.
Yeah.
Not those peoples and the earth who are actually working away to produce our options, yes. But the sense now is, in the way that technology's going, is that you know, with even our relationships now are options on dating agencies. You know, where we live, where we rent, it's an option on a real estate site. Do you know that our whole life is kind of laid out now in this electronic domain? So that... I'm just kind of give a vague hint of how technology actually forms our understanding of what is. Even though, at another level, we've got a kind of a different understanding of what is. Oh, here's a table.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, here's a chair. And we've got there's not just one understanding of being, we've got multiple levels of it in a way. But I'm trying to get back to, I often have trouble getting off the first slide. Where was I? Yes, about this view of science coming from Newton, which is reductionistic, is the kind of formal term for it. It's a kind of an idea that everything that we encounter essentially can be broken down into smaller and smaller parts until you get down to the molecular, the atomic and the subatomic levels. And the sort of, there's an understanding of being there that says, if we can understand matter at that level, then we can understand everything else. In physics, there's still this idea of the theory of everything, in a way, that if we get down to those basic, and you probably, those, you've got a few basic constants, a few basic concepts and forces, and we if we can form a piece of mathematics in a way that that can describe what happens at the Big Bang, and then the whole of the rest of the universe can be kind of extracted out of this mathematical model, and everything that happens, the formation of the stars, the formation of the planets, life on Earth, the whole scheme can be expanded out of the interaction of these fundamental forces and particles. There's an understanding of being in physics there that's reductionistic, in the sense that it's if we understand how the small parts interact, we understand everything else. And then for people who really hold that, something like a human being is a sort of an illusion. The reality are all the neurons, all the cells. You know, the reality of our intelligence is just the interaction of these physical neurons in the brain. And if we start talking about consciousness, that's a kind of almost a misunderstanding that we have. And I know people who think this, and it's very hard to even have a conversation with somebody who's got that view of things. But the point I'm making here is that modern science, really 20th century science, got over that. Actual science got over that. Quantum physics got into some very strange areas where our sort of ordinary reductionistic understanding of the being of things broke down. And we don't have to go into what quantum physics has to say, but because I'm not a quantum physicist, for one reason. But there are the kind of sense that that everything can be explained in terms of atoms and molecules died a long time ago, and yet it still lives on in the understanding, in our sort of common understanding, particularly in biology. And biology too is changing, but in biology, the discovery of DNA after the Second World War was a up until then, there'd been a kind of an argument between the vitalists, if you like, and the mechanists. The vitalists were saying, so physics, you can understand rocks and planets and suns, but you can never really explain the life in entirely physical terms. The formation of a body, particularly the morphogenesis of our physical bodies. How could it be that those atoms and molecules knew how to grow a body? There must be some other intelligence that forms.
But when you study biophysics has a relation between biology and physics.
Well, now this is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. With the discovery of DNA, mm-hmm. That was the discovery, if you like, by the people who thought that everything can be reduced down to molecules. Mm-hmm. Was saying, well, here it is. Here's the molecule. Here's the molecule that has the program that builds human bodies. In a way, that was a victory for all of the people who thought that everything could be explained entirely mechanistically.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? And that a whole idea of vitalism, and that there's some additional life force that forms bodies, died away. Not completely, because the remaining puzzle, if you like, for that form of science is consciousness. Your DNA molecule doesn't explain consciousness. But in a way, consciousness just got kind of sidelined, put over there and said, well, it's a problem we can't fully, explain entirely mechanistically, but we've explained all these other things entirely mechanistically. Give us some time. But essentially, I mean, anyone who studies consciousness seriously realizes that it's a question of a different order. It's not something that could ever be explained mechanistically. Once you grasp what consciousness is, and grasping what consciousness is an extraordinarily difficult thing for someone who can't do anything but define and think about things. Because the only knowledge that we have of consciousness is our being conscious. You can't point and say consciousness, whatever you say consciousness is, whatever definition you give of it, somebody can say, well, no, it's not, it's that. Oh, no, it's not, it's that. But it's essentially, the philosophy of consciousness, if I'm giving the course again, is if you don't know what it is, I can't tell you. I mean, I often, particularly with my colleagues, I had to say things like, well, are you conscious now? Are you? How do you know? Do you have to look in a book? Do you have to check on your phone? How do you know that you're conscious? Now, and I put it to you that the knowledge that you're conscious is so utterly immediate that it precedes everything else. You're knowing that you're conscious isn't like knowing that there's a computer on the table. It's that by means of which you come to know there's a computer on the table. It precedes everything. And to think that you need to define consciousness or prove in some way that it exists is, from the place of consciousness, an utter absurdity. But what happens, particularly in science, do we have one more chair? Yes, we do. This is another, I'm explaining science in a way. If somebody's doing science seriously, you actually inhabit what's called a third person perspective. You abstract yourself deliberately out of your subjectivity. And so everything becomes an object for you that you study, including human brains. You know, you've abstracted yourself out of your consciousness, your immediate subject.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you sit there and you look back and you say, well, where's consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you've the very abstraction is in a way an unconsciousness. Because, of course, however far you abstract yourself, it's still your consciousness that's doing the looking. So there's a deep problem in science in relation to being able to understand that science can't explain consciousness.
Parallel problem with not being able to understand language without using language.
It is.
Without what?
Yes.
Without using language.
Yes.
You can't understand consciousness without using consciousness.
Yes.
You can't understand language without using language.
Yes. But one thing I'd like to say is, once you have to test this in your own experience, is that your knowing that you're conscious is. It may be the one and only thing that you know that precedes language. Now, you can't express it, you can't understand it, you can't articulate it, you can't even make it known to yourself that you're conscious without in some way having language. But I put it to you, and if anyone has looked, has seriously gone into meditation. Consciousness is conscious of being conscious. That's what consciousness is. It's if you're going to give a definition of consciousness, it's an utter circularity. It says nothing. But in a way, if you're conscious, you do understand it. What it is to be conscious is to be conscious of being conscious. It's a self-reflective state. So whatever, whether it's language, whether you're looking at something, whether you're feeling pain, every experience that you have, there is always consciousness there. If there's no consciousness there, you're not having any experience. The two are just they're not separable. So I digress just a little bit. I'd say that it's not that language and consciousness are stuck.
No, I just thought it was a bit of an analogy.
It's an analogy, because yes. So what I'm wanting to say is that there's been a movement in science lately, in the latter part of the 20th century and now, which is challenging that. And you could say that the kind of biggest example of it, that's kind of one of the biggest reasons for it, is the climate crisis. Because somewhere along the lines, somebody sort of dimly starts to realise that the entire Earth is a unified system, and that our whole approach of industrialization and the whole approach of our science has just concentrated on putting the little bits together and trying to understand cause and effect from looking at the parts and how the parts interact. And of course, that kind of cause and effect thinking it can never reach to any kind of holistic understanding of anything, only in principle or theoretically. You can't go from
this is to Socrates. Socrates say many years ago. Socrates say, I don't remember really the sentence, but I know. Que you know, que I understand, que no understand all. I think so. Que the translation they sent the Socrates. Yes.
Oh yeah, we have Greek. We have the Greek language here.
Yes. Perfect. Yes. The human people no cover all. O sea, you try to learn about interpretation all and understand all, analyze all, but the people no cover all. No cover all. Try people no cover all.
But not understanding.
Yes, o sea, the people try to understand the things, try the interpretation things, but the people and your mind not try the, o sea, the mind not try the core or no possible core no. Knowledge.
No, but what I'm talking about now in system science is not to understand everything.
Mm.
It's to recognize that there are different levels of being,
mm.
and that you can't understand, let's say, the totality of a human being entirely in terms of atoms and molecules. That when you study a system, and this is systems thinking, you have to recognize that a human being has entirely different properties to a neuron. I mean, it's obvious. This isn't a difficult idea. It's a kind of an obvious idea. It's only recently that it's become recognized, particularly in biology,
mm-hmm.
that it's worthwhile to think in terms of systems rather than in terms of interactions of molecules. Yes.
The thing is, it's just because the evidence is out there, and it's almost like two approaches that are in war with one another, because. First of all, if you believe in evolution, and you start from basic kind of proteins and stuff, or some proteins came to be randomly and they kind of randomly formed, and all this, at what point does this become conscious? So this is why there's one problem with consciousness is not. Mechanistic, because the origin of everything, if you say that the origin is mechanistic, whereby there was just energy and energy became matter and all of this soup, primordial soup.
Yes, primordial soup.
Primordial soup.
Everyone's familiar with this, because this is a story that you're telling.
Yeah.
I actually want to check everyone knows the story, because this is
yeah.
this is in our world our creation myth, isn't it?
Yeah. So our creation, the scientific creation myth.
Yeah.
Is not God created, it's some nothingness turns
yeah.
into somethingness. And
yeah,
then
well it's getting more refined. I mean the idea is that 3.5 billion years ago, I think that's about roughly where they're putting it, there were a lot of complex hydrocarbon molecules floating around in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Just by bumping into each other, you know, by random interactions, this is the thinking that a certain kind of molecule developed that was able to replicate itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was swimming around in the ocean, and it started to be. It would attract other chemical bonds with itself, and it would then actually be able to split and form copies of itself. And as soon as something starts to form copies of itself like that, it's like a chain reaction, you know.
Yeah.
And lots of different kinds of hydrocarbons started to be able to replicate themselves in this oceanic sea. Yeah. And then all
and
you needed
here
was
and there some variations,
yeah.
And what do you call them, mutations, and then mm-hmm. one mutation is more successful. And
but not. I mean, the next thing you need is a membrane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, but it's not so hard to picture that at a certain point it would be possible for a membrane to form around some of these self-replicating molecules. And there's a general story that goes from there to the membrane with the self-replicating molecule within it the membrane itself starts to be able to replicate itself and all the chemicals within it, and there is the birth of the cell. And once you've got the cell without any intelligence in it, You know, it's a small step then actually to multicellular creatures, and you know, yada yada yada, here's the human being. Do you know that's in a way that's our creation myth,
mm-hmm.
And part of that. I know I've interrupted.
No, that's fine.
But because it's part of what I wanted to say here.
But that's a big grapple, because it's like, you know, if we believe in that. Then at some point you need to say, and then happened a miracle and consciousness appeared. If you don't believe that consciousness is some sort of a result or a manifestation of this, so where, at what point is suddenly bang with that consciousness, which is separate, nothing to do with all of this, is when is that? And this is why it's so difficult, you know. And then we know that, like, you know, we go to sleep and consciousness disappears every day for a few hours. You know, I mean, if there was a CCTV, you know, you could look at yourself sleeping, but you don't remember you sleeping. And when we die, we die. So, and then the body decomposes. And so it's kind of like, I'm kind of, when we say the theory of everything nowadays, we think about like quantum physics and all the other four laws and whatever, not coming together, but it's really the theory of everything
has to include that, yes.
Because I think so, okay, the problem between the conscient and subconscient, because when the people sleep, it's the subconscient, is they recognize the this molecule and this evolution will transfer, recognize the environment, evolution, and grow out more in intelligence and in ideas.
Yeah, I don't think that consciousness is still somewhere in there. It just goes into some sort of different mode or something.
So the question of consciousness is, I almost feel it's for another. It is for another course, which I will be teaching. Yes, although I'm tempted to give an answer, because of course I think about this a lot. But I think we've got to.
Yeah.
But the question of evolution is crucial to this. To this class, because there's a story behind evolution that is not even to do with it being mechanistic, that says something like this, that after that the entire process of evolution is a kind of you know the phrase nature red in tooth and claw, it's a kind of a vicious competition and survival of the fittest. That's the what's called the neo-Darwinian view. I haven't lost the deeper context of this is the myth of our Western scientific culture, which is essentially economically a survival of the fittest kind of culture. And there's a certain level here where biology says, and we have a kind of a demonstration of where our culture came from evolution itself. Do you know that it was like a reading back almost of the way our culture is structured. It's read back into the theory of evolution that says, okay, so the only way that evolution happens is through life and death, and whoever manages to reproduce, their genetic material survives, and that lineage of animals survives, and we're at the end of the lineage of that tree of life that survived, and we basically survived, you know, through killing and eating each other. Put very simplistically, that's our creation myth. That's the creation myth I was fed anyway. Do you know? Because it used to be Adam and Eve, you know, and the eating the apple. And Adam and Eve are actually still there. This creation myth has been layered on top of it. Do you know? If you look back into our cultural history, now Maturana is living in a place here where he is, and if you've done the reading, you probably know this already. He is challenging that interpretation of evolution.
With this account, they removed nature from the supernature with this simple primary and the whole story. And that means that nature has no authority. Because once you remove that, and consciousness was lost out of, came out of the map with it, because there's no supernature, that means you're not. There's no.
What do you mean by supernature?
Supernature, I don't know, the divine being, something like that. God, angels, I don't know, whatever, celestial.
Yes, at a certain point with Darwin, and I think, you know, the late 1800s, there was, and it's kind of a process completed with the First World War, there was a collapse in the idea that there was a divine intelligence operating and in some way intending things to be the way they are. I've got a feeling, I almost feel it, you know, in me, like you're in the trenches, you know, and once again the whistle blows and you've got to go over there and watch everyone be machine gunned down, and when you get there you've got to, I mean, just awful, you know. You could kind of feel Christianity was having difficulty with Darwin, you know, and it died. European Christianity died somewhere in the mud of Flanders as a living, as something that the people, it certainly in Europe, could, not that people immediately gave up their religion, but somewhere something got broken in that experience. And in a way, as a result of that being broken, it's not that everyone believed in science. It was like, well, science was all that was left. Do you know, in the sort of history of our terrible history of the human race, in a way.
When was the phrase "God is dead" come about?
That was Nietzsche in about 1880s. In the 1880s, he in a way was prophetic, but I guess he was at the edge of what we would say was European consciousness at that time, where in some way or other, you know, the church, the Christian church, decided to take on Darwin, and lost. And at a certain level, demonstrated its own lack of understanding of itself. Do you know, a living religion, a living intelligent religion, could have absorbed what Darwin had to say. I'm thinking of European history. It took on Darwin and said, that can't be. You're saying that we evolved from the apes? It just can't be. And, you know, creationism is still there, really, right down to the level of, well, you know, God did create the fossils, But we didn't. Evolution didn't actually happen. They were all, you know, 3,000 years ago, or whatever. The fossils were just,
yeah.
You know, we have to question. I mean, it reminds me of Descartes. If God did do that, then God was having a bit of a laugh, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
You know, with us, he must have known we would find the fossils and start piecing it together. You know, there's a.
And then he'd be quite mean, so he'd be a...
No, exactly. He'd be a deceiver. You remember Descartes? God couldn't, an all-loving God couldn't be a deceiver.
And God is not the highest authority. It's man who's like the highest authority.
Exactly. Once God goes, and you've got the whole history now of European philosophy and existentialism, right? Once the idea of a deity that was behind it all has disappeared, then what's left? We're with Jean-Paul Sartre. We're just left with our awful freedom that we can't bear to face.
It's not awful.
That's it.
It's a damn sight better than bloody religion.
Yeah, I was. I don't like. I didn't want to get Maria started. That's right. This isn't an argument to bring back Christianity. No. It isn't, but it's just a kind of a giving a sense of this.
But in one sense, they lost the battle because they were, you know, they weren't kind of wise enough to embed the kind of evolution into, okay, admitting that, you know, whatever is written in the Holy Scripts is maybe man-made understanding of the world, but actually here we got a scientific. But you know that they haven't lost because we're still with the consciousness issue.
Yes.
And that's where they could have kind of like say, okay, so yeah, the 6 days creation is a nice myth that our ancestors developed because they hadn't had the science then, and now we understand maybe it's evolution, whatever. But consciousness is a proof that there is a higher. Or another, at least, dimension of reality that science doesn't describe, and this is where we're today in a way.
But I think you. I think you.
The conscience interpretation, the facts. So the facts is the creation, yes. And the science try to explain this.
Yes. In a way, what we just to kind of summarize that, there was not there. God didn't have to die.
Yeah.
It didn't have to have been that way, but that's the way it went for our kind of collective. You know, there's a. It's not that the facts of evolution dictate one way or the other about the idea of there being some kind of universal consciousness, if you like, or universal being. It doesn't say one way or the other. It just says, well, you know, here are a lot of fossils.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's what happened. Here are the facts. The theory of evolution is a way of putting the facts together. One way of putting them.
John, were we not back in language in that language was framing the reality, and here we have the fight between, you know, what was being said, the survival of the fittest. The fittest isn't necessarily the superior, but the fight began between Christianity or religion and science, and as you said earlier on, that split was happening, two different languages trying to speak to each other and not communicating.
Yes.
And so the one that was dominant and had the baton to batter, you know, someone over the head, won that argument.
Because in this moment, I'm just using materials and
we're
spirituals.
Talking about two myths here.
Yes.
And two myths in conflict.
Yes.
And we're living, you know, I'm going back to you saying we're living this, you know, we're living it. So here's an example of the living of it.
Yes. That is. It is. And we have the Christian myth, and we have the myth of what has become a materialistic science.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't, you know, the science was not materialistic in the way that we experience it now, until that schism, if you like, that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that we had a bunch of atheistic scientists who were dead set on destroying religion. It was more. But in a way, you know, we could go into it. You know how history is. It's got all of these dimensions, and we're just taking a very superficial look at it. But I feel I need to do this enormous introduction to shoo you into what Maturana's saying, because the entire reading this week is because it's about the origins of language, if I can bring it back. Because in that survival of the fittest model, there's a kind of idea that language evolved because it made us it enabled us to survive. You know, it was like axes and tools and spears. It was a kind of an accidental thing that occurred with our particular species that we random mutation of genes explains evolution. There was some kind of random mutation that enabled our brains to grow to the point where we started to language. We started to be able to. I mean, what did happen was the neocortex, the top layer of the brain, started to grow and grow and grow. And because, I mean, my understanding of it now is that it enables us as a species to predict the future more effectively, predict the consequences of our actions and the actions of the environment. We could see a bit further ahead, and as we saw a bit further ahead, we were better able to survive, better able to hunt. So the whole impulse, the more brain you got, the further ahead you can see, until the width of the hips precludes the fact it can grow any further. Yes.
I don't know anything about sort of the biology of early humans, so I'm asking, when did the neocortex develop before Homo sapiens?
Yes,
so it was present in Neanderthals.
Yes. So cortex itself, a neocortex is something associated with mammals.
Right.
So this is my, general. I used to be a vegetarian, but now it's nothing with a neocortex for me. So yes.
Animals have neocortex. Mammals.
Yes.
Mice and stuff.
Yes. It's a trait of the mammals, and we're part of the mammal family.
So you eat bivalves, and you say nothing with the neocortex.
Do chicken.
You eat bivalves.
You can eat birds. That's what it means.
Birds don't have that.
They don't have a neocortex.
No, they have something like a neocortex. Yes. No, I don't mean it. It's half a joke. It's because Nicolette pulled me into eating chicken, and that's how I justified the chicken. You know, I won't eat lambs and cows.
So you're saying that language doesn't evolve as soon as you see a neocortex.
No, it's not about having a neocortex.
Oh.
It's about having a lot of neocortex.
Ah.
Yes. So in a sense, one level you would say language, that in this story, language evolved because we had excess capacity. Because in a way you need a whole you have to have the capacity to develop a symbolic layer. See, what language does is it enables you to we weren't going to talk about language, but let's say one aspect of what language in this model, bearing in mind we're in a model, a scientific model of the evolution of the brain, and this is speculative as well, that there's a sort of a level of thinking which is purely associative, that you could see that I think if you observe your dog, you might see that the dog has a kind of a capacity for associative thinking, like something will remind the dog of something else. Yes? But what language enables you to do is to head off into a virtual reality. You can start, because you've got a symbolic layer in your mind, you can start to think of something, and entire situations that aren't present in front of you, and neither, and you don't have to have been reminded of them by something that's just happened. You actually, there's a kind of a snip between you and the present, and your immediate experience. So you could, one way of saying how does animal consciousness, mammalian animal consciousness, differ from ours, is that we can actually, and we do, right? We go off. We can leave the present entirely, and we can. Basically, we can imagine something like the world we live in. You know, the world we live in is something that has been imagined in people's minds, because we've got to a possibility of utterly abstracting ourselves from the immediacy of our present environment. And so this theory says you need a lot of neocortex to do that, because the immediate layers of the neocortex are utterly involved in sensory, just handling your senses.
Is that, that's the case? You say this is speculative, or just a theory. But
yes.
Is it not actually the case? If you took somebody's neocortex off, they wouldn't be able to
quality the interconnection.
So, just to answer Maria's question, the brain is not, how the brain works is not understood in that, you know, there's an awful lot of understanding about how neurons work, and there's a lot of understanding about if you have brain damage in that area of the brain, what effects it has on your behaviour, but how the brain in its entirety interacts and produces my ability to speak is not understood.
Right.
Do you know, it's a very primitive understanding that we have, despite, you know, whenever a scientist gets up, they very rarely say we've got a very primitive understanding of anything, because of course it's much more sophisticated than yours. But in a sense, it's still very speculative about how the brain works and even what it's doing. It's only recent brain theory that has finally come to see that the brain is essentially involved in prediction, the neocortex anyway, but that's its job. It's continuously, for those of you who haven't done my course, the kind of latest thinking is that you're continuously predicting what's happening. I don't mean you're predicting tomorrow, you're predicting what I'm going to say next. But not just what I'm going to say next, you're predicting what I'm saying now. And in a way, what you're experiencing is the meeting of this stream of prediction in your brain, with the quite limited information coming in through the senses, and the two meet, and you get what you perceive as a kind of largely it's a confirmation of what you're expecting, but what you're expecting is very sophisticated. It's informed by what's just immediately happened. You see, you're not just dreaming. You wouldn't be able to predict. Sorry about this side issue. You wouldn't be able to predict exactly what the phone would look like if I picked it up right now. But as I pick it up, you're able to predict very accurately how it's going to look in the very next second, the very next fraction of a second. You know exactly how it should translate itself, because you've just had the very last second, the very last tenth of a second, as the basis on which you predict. You see, so you're always predicting right down on the moment. And so a mouse, you know, a lot of the mammals themselves, that you would say that their neocortex is almost entirely concerned with just handling now.
But we get a sense of that prediction, because, you know, when you're going downstairs and you think there's another stair.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And then you actually feel your body sinking down into an imaginary
yes.
step.
Yes.
And I suppose that must be the brain predicting.
and that's the, that's
there's going to be another
exactly
step, and then there isn't, and bang.
And that's the phenomenology. You see that,
yeah.
it's like, this is where phenomenology and brain science join, because you can if you're attentive enough, you can start to recognise this continual state of prediction whenever a prediction isn't met.
Is prediction the right word in this case? For
well, the theories of prediction.
I'm not sure.
Expectation?
What you mean when you say that, like, we are. So we have some sort of a stream of consciousness that's predicting something that's just about to happen, and then it meets with something that comes in from senses.
Yes.
And then we perceive it again, or we kind of, so...
So, I mean, without going into too much detail,
yeah.
It's a current model, if you like, is that there's a hierarchical structure. There's a very high-level prediction here that says, I'm in this room, and there are some people around. Do you know? I'll be with you in a minute. And then at a lower level, you get down to predicting the individual people, and then there's the prediction of actually what I'm actually looking at. All of that is streaming down, and it's attempting to predict exactly what's coming in through the senses. And now, if the senses, if it matches, then in the hierarchy, it all stops there. But if something's coming in through the senses that the prediction doesn't match, then it says it either enforces its prediction. I mean, and there's a whole study in this about how it's attuned. So it ignores the senses, and you can demonstrate this happens. Or if it's basically working on probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
It's working out what's the most probable thing I'm seeing here. But if there's a big mismatch, then it falls back to the next layer in the hierarchy, and it reassesses what it thinks is happening. And if it goes higher up in the hierarchy, you get a catastrophic reassessment, and somewhere up here you start recognising you were having a hallucination. Do you know? But there's an entire structure there. It's the word prediction is just the word now that the research is using, because they're all computationalists. All the people working on the brain just regard it as a big computer.
I was once in Spain, and the owner of the house at the Airbnb told me that there's an Armenian girl coming. Yeah, no Armenian, I can speak up. So I didn't tell her, when she came, I didn't tell her that I'm Armenian or anything. So I started speaking to her in English, and I started throwing a few Armenian sentences. Yeah, and I thought that she, you know, she found out that I'm Armenian. But I started speaking Armenian. But like very short, and then continue speaking in English so that others can understand me. And then she asked me, where are you from? And I told her,
yeah,
I was speaking Armenian to
you.
So what? She was traveling for a whole year. It's very unlikely to meet up from her. She never met any Armenian. So she wasn't expecting at all to meet an Armenian person. So these words that I used, she didn't get them. She didn't hear it. I said, oh,
She didn't understand them.
When I was speaking to her, I threw in a few Armenian sentences.
Because I don't always know whether I'm speaking English or French.
When
I was speaking with my mother sometimes, because she would be speaking in French to me and I'd be speaking in English. But then sometimes I'd lapse into French.
Mm.
If you'd ask me afterwards.
Were
you speaking French
right.
or English? I'd say, I really can't remember.
Right.
I don't know. I wasn't aware.
So she didn't register the...
She may not have registered the
And she got surprised when I was like,
yeah.
Can't you see that I was speaking Armenian?
That's quite common. I mean, I often don't know what
that
means.
That's
an example of that. Certain, if you like, in this hierarchy, that she'd understood you to not be Armenian because of the context of where she was,
yeah.
And that your Armenianness was overridden by her expectation that
there's
no Armenians here.
Do
you know that? Yes.
You know what? When I spoke to an Armenian.
Yes.
That's
like the gorilla. You know that with the people that were there was that famous experiment where people were throwing a ball to each other.
Mm.
You know, and you had to concentrate because it might be thrown to you at any moment. And somebody in a gorilla suit walked right through the middle of them, and nobody saw it. Yes.
I think so. Que en about the prediction, lo muy importante es the interpretation. Si yo no interpretation correctly, no coming or no come of the every person the prediction. If for interpretation, you need or have inside pre ideas and pre context. Yes, pre ideas.
Pre ideas.
Es posible que coming the genetic way or for any contact with others or with. And in this case, si the evolution del Netherland, the Homo sapiens had interaction with other, he make in herself pre-context and pre-ideas. And when these pre-ideas and pre-context possible, evolution and create interpretation and prediction. But the people need in general perspective. Si the people had perspective, had vision for understand others and may intercoach and communication skills. At the moment the people in the human people need interpretation of the world, but need interpretation of the world and need interpretation of others. If we need interpretation of others, need realistic speed with others. If for speed with others, the person need intercoach and communication skills for this. No es solo interpretation.
But for what we're talking about here in relation to this brain theory,
yes,
it hasn't even got near language. It hasn't, it's a very mechanistic, simplistic, you know, that's why I'm saying that it's...
Yes, but the mechanism is really...
But somebody holding that theory would say, well, what the higher levels of the neocortex is doing the interpreting. The prediction is the interpretation.
Yes.
So, and it's full of interpretation. Mm-hmm. But where exactly how it works, nobody's got to that level with the brain in terms of the mechanisms of how it's going to work, but they're working on it. And of course I was too, and not only are they working on it, they're working on computer programs that do exactly the same thing. So it's not just theory. The theory immediately becomes technology. You know, this is how we live now. You know, as soon as we get the tiniest clue about how the brain works, there's a program.
This is unfortunate.
Yeah, that's
unfortunate.
So now we're getting back somewhere to the thread of what we're talking about, which is that about Maturana being a systems biologist, which is a branch of biology that's grown up in recent times due to the failure of the Human Genome Project. I don't know if you if anyone remembers when they first mapped the human genome. When was it now? Early 2000s, was it?
I think it's around 2000.
Yeah.
2001.
There was a whole thing there that said, once we've mapped the human genome, there's going to be all these incredible medical advances, right? We're going to find the gene for cancer, you know, the gene for heart disease. You know, the gene for this, the gene for that. We're just going to map all the diseases that we've got, all the human diseases, back to the genes, and kabing. It's going to be like antibiotics, you know, to the power of three. We're going to be, genetic engineering is going to be able to produce amazing results because all we have to do is switch this one on, switch that one off. I mean, there was the general view of it was that the DNA was like this kind of genetic code. Like a bunch of switches, and the switches all caused something in a linear way, and of course it's I don't know if you're aware of this, but that's not how it works. The way that diseases occur and the way that character traits occur in your body is a complex system of interactions between multiple genes and between all the complex proteins that are in the cell. And there's no A causes B.
Environment and food and everything affects gene expression, doesn't it? But
environment,
and your diet.
Yes, which is environment.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So your
state of mind.
Well, your state of mind. I mean, for your mechanistic biologists, your state of mind produces certain chemicals, which then interacts with the way that the cell works. And there's no. There was a kind of a shock in a way, and Western science is engaged in this shock, but it's quite a mathematical shock, which is that we understand very well how to mathematically understand linear systems. Linear systems are predictable for us, which is just an expression of the form of mathematics, which we generally understand as cause and effect. A causes B, because it may be complex, maybe A, B and C need to be there for D to happen. But a system becomes complex as soon as there's feedback. As soon as, A and B causes C, but then C changes A. And as soon as something becomes complex like that, it becomes a non-linear system. And it becomes virtually impossible to predict how it will behave. Not in that ABC kind of cause and effect model that was Western science's engine. You know, it's the engine of industrialization, the engine, this is what sends rockets to the moon. You isolate things in laboratory experiments, and you deliberately make sure there's only A, and you deliberately make sure there's only B. You put them together, they produce C, and you say, great. But as soon as you put anything back into the world, it becomes embedded in a what we call a complex system, and things become utterly unpredictable, not just because they're complex, but it's becoming recognized now that they're inherently unpredictable. It's not a matter of we'll get better instruments and they'll become predictable. It's the butterfly effect, you know, sensitivity to initial conditions. Some systems are so sensitive to initial conditions that you're never going to predict exactly what's going to happen. The butterfly, I don't know if it's still part of culture, you know, it's the idea that a butterfly flapping its wings in the Amazon rainforest causes a thunderstorm in Brighton. You know, and in a way, there is a connection, and the world's weather system is just such a system. It doesn't matter. At the moment, if you had sensors in every square cubic meter of the Earth, you still couldn't predict the weather with accuracy more than a few hours ahead.
Even though it is deterministic, it is a deterministic system, but it's so complicated, complex that it's nearly irrelevant as deterministic.
But the sensitivity to initial conditions is so fine that you can never narrow it down. And the question as to whether it's deterministic is another issue. I mean, it finally comes back to, does my being conscious alter anything? Mm. Of all those micro-interactions between all those micro-particles, does my being conscious alter any of that? And this is an existential question, because if it doesn't, then we're a kind of we're non-entities living a totally false life. You know, all our thoughts about what I'm going to do, that I matter, that I've got free will, that I'm responsible for what I do, that when you hit me, you did something wrong. Just a robot. Expelling molecules of air.
Is that where we're moving?
But doesn't Maturana have something about that?
Maturana stays neutral. This is one of the annoying things about Maturana. He never explicitly steps over the line and says consciousness makes a difference. I mean, consciousness, if I'm allowed to say it, obviously makes a difference. Those of you who have been to my classes before will have heard me say this, but my demonstration, which I have attempted to communicate to people in the area, I won't go into their responses because it would make you cry. But consciousness obviously makes a difference because I am able to speak of it.
Surely what you're saying about if we're all just robots, surely you can only be a robot by contrast to something which is conscious.
Well, that's another... That's another brilliant point. You see, we only something that's conscious could conceive of what the difference would be between being conscious and being a robot, for example. And you might say, well, what difference does that make? Well, it doesn't. It makes a difference that it's made my jaw go up and down. Do you know? It's made these sounds, these molecules come out of my. They come from the fact that I'm conscious.
The way I experience myself is that only bit of me is conscious, thank goodness, because when I'm walking around, I don't have to think about putting one foot in front of the other. I don't have to think about digesting my food. I don't have to think about all sorts of things. But I can direct my consciousness to those things and make them conscious. But I think largely, I mean, like for instance, at the moment, I wanted to shift myself back in my chair, and I did that. I was going to do that automatically, and then I suddenly became conscious of it. But a lot of what we do isn't conscious, and it, thank goodness, because otherwise we would be, you know, it'd be very difficult to live, wouldn't it?
Well, and we're off in another direction here. But I feel I just want to say, for my own view of this, is that. It's very rare. You've got a certain understanding of consciousness there that says, "Well, I consciously reached over and touched the computer," and I'm there's a this view of consciousness that I just expressed that says everything's determined by the lower level entities is called epiphenomenalism, and it would acknowledges that we're conscious. It just says. It makes no difference that we're conscious. And my view is that actually it's very rare that our being consciousness, God consciousness, actually rises to the level where it can make a difference. Because most of the time we're just chuntering along. Even when we say, what cheese are you going to have? Well, I'll have, would you like a coffee with... white or black? I'll have white, please. Two sugars. There's a sense where you can almost, if you look at it carefully, you can see the mechanism of your own responses in life just going on. And you don't really need to be there. And quite often you're not. But sometimes you are and sometimes you're not. And sometimes your being there is just, it doesn't make any difference. There's a level where... almost, you've got my sense is that you only really become conscious when you disidentify sufficiently to recognize that you're conscious, and in a way, when you do that, you're doing nothing. It's just a, it's like a. I mean, it's called in. I don't know. I mentioned Gurdjieff before. It's called self-remembering in. Mm-hmm. In Gurdjieffian terms.
Yeah.
Do you know, it's just a... Oh my God, I'm here. Do you know, I'm here. You know, because most of the time... I'm sort of here.
Yeah.
You know, I do see things.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not actually here. Do you know? And I think only in that state of... Oh my God, I'm here. It's only in that state that you can... I mean, Gurdjieff said that you can do. That you have anything like will. And my sense of will is actually probably the best we can do is negate something. I think in that moment of consciousness, probably the only power that I really recognise that we have is to say, I withdraw. I reject that. Often it's some form of negativity. You know, you need a certain consciousness to see how the negativity is coming my way, and if you've got sufficient consciousness, you can hold the ground, and that makes a difference. I think that does make a difference. But in our ordinary, you know, I wouldn't like to say what percentage of what I'm doing now is just me on automatic pilot. I don't know. One of the things about language I'd like you all to appreciate is when you're actually speaking, who is doing it? Do you know? Have you ever got that? You just fall back into consciousness now. I mean, you're listening to my voice. It could be your voice, couldn't it? It's just coming out of nowhere for me. You know, I'm just listening to it coming out.
Whilst we might be on autopilot because we've got such an affinity with where we are or the kind of soup that we're living in, but you don't get that when you're in a foreign country, when you are speaking a foreign language. I get what Maria was saying, that you might have this idea that you can go from one language to another with your mother, not really know, but you don't necessarily get that in terms of spoke about environment earlier, just very briefly, but you are totally somewhere else. And I think there, in terms of that, the system wanting to learn, got examples here in terms of people learning English in 6 months. I think there is, you can step up that gear, but you've got to, there's got to be a number of factors which lead you to do that. And I don't think, it's not just a, it's not just a state of some kind of meditative thing that enables you to do that, although I'm sure that kind of helps where you can stand your ground, but I think you need to, you do step up, don't you?
Well, my own perspective is informed, I guess, in the back of my mind by me being a computer scientist. So in the back of my mind, I can see, okay, I've now programmed a neocortex. What's it going to be able to do? Pretty much everything. I fear it's coming. Pretty much everything that we can do, language is the dodgy area. Is it going to be able to perfectly mimic our ability to use language? I fear so. I think about where would it break down, and it's going to break down when it comes to understanding consciousness. That's where. Of course, it's going to be able to mimic our ability to speak of consciousness, but it's not. It's not going to be able to, how can I put it? If we make the machine deduce from its own input what kind of universe it's in, it will not find consciousness.
I'm just thinking about what you said about how conscious are when we speak. Just like with walking, I mean, if I go into the shop I go to in every week and ask for the paper.
I don't want to spoil it for you, Maria, but like right now, how conscious are you right now of what you're saying?
I'm conscious that I have prepared something in my mind that I wanted to say.
Yes.
And that I'm saying it.
But as it's coming out, isn't it just coming out?
Isn't it just coming out?
Yeah, you're not doing it.
Thing is,
there's no consciousness needed for it. You're conscious of the sounds that are coming out of your mouth, but you know what we're talking about whether there's any will involved.
Yes, because
feel there is, right?
And I was going to.
But is there?
Yes, because I was going to make a distinction between coming out with stuff that I habitually come out with. I go into the shop to buy a newspaper. I always say the same thing. Hi, how are you? Nice day.
Yeah, but right now you're coming out with new stuff, aren't you? Yes? I don't want to disturb.
I'm saying, but if I suddenly saw that the shopkeeper who I see every week was crying, something would
change.
You know, a bit like the step.
Yes.
You
and I know that. I understand that, Maria.
And then you become conscious of what you're saying, because you have to change. You have to change the script.
You're at another level.
Yes.
From your level of consciousness before.
Yes.
So there are different levels of consciousness.
Yes.
But I'm talking about, when does your being conscious actually make a difference to the way you behave? And you're assuming that you behave, you know, when the woman's crying, you've got an assumption there that you're behaving differently because of consciousness. And I'm saying, I'm putting the doubt in your mind that in fact, no, you just, because something unexpected's happened, you've become more conscious, but the machine's still doing it.
So I'm doing something.
There's just a bit more consciousness in the machine as it's doing it.
I'm doing something a computer could never do, and that's feel empathy.
Well, that's not a doing, that's a feeling.
Yes, exactly. I'm saying feelings, when they come in,
I know we're in a sidetrack here, but I'm talking about, but how does that change your behaviour? And I know you're going to say, oh my, because I felt empathy, that changed my behaviour. And I'm saying,
well, a lot of things that you do, I knew this from this pianist Bill Evans, and I was listening to an interview with him, so like, everything you do in music, right, is that at some point you did it consciously.
Yeah.
And then it became a habit, and then on that you built something else on top of that, and then it turns into a habit or mechanism, right?
But what we're dealing with here is language. You've got to be careful with language. You're confusing doing something habitually and not doing something habitually with, and I'm not talking about that. Our ordinary language says that, oh yeah, I do something habitually, I wasn't conscious, and then I don't, I'm conscious of what I'm doing. I get that, right? We all do that. I'm saying, I'm suggesting that actually being conscious means more than that.
Yeah. However, there's a being conscious.
And I think possibly with music, and any time that you're inspired, creatively inspired, then maybe there's something going on there as well, where the machine's no longer.
The machine responds to that.
Yes. The machine's sensitive,
yes,
to some, what we might call something that's outside or beyond the machine.
The whole idea of practicing is developing a reception mechanism for that kind of. I think that's a.
But with artistic inspiration, that's not your will either, is it? You're just receptive to something that's not of the machine.
Yeah, of course.
So we had a little wander there, a big wander. So let's come back, if we can. We're going to have a break. I know, I can feel that. Generally, we can do 2 hours, and as usual, 2 hours, and I haven't started the first slide yet.
Can you start with them? Because I would like.
All right. I think.
Not now, but. Like,
I think after lunch we're going to go through the slides and not. And we're going to just listen to what Maturana has to say if I can possibly do that, but I still haven't finished my why I chose Maturana. Right, the reason I chose Maturana is because he provides a different scientific understanding of the origins of language that isn't embedded in our idea that evolution is essentially competitive. Right, he challenges this deep idea that the process of evolution is a survival of the fittest. Only the cruelest and the most ruthless are going to survive. And that in certain sense, evolution is proof of that. Right? That's quite a deep idea in our culture.
And the dynamics of our relationship is nothing but domination and submission.
Yeah. If you go into the evolutionary biologists, they even go into, and if you show anything like altruistic behaviour, it's because somewhere back in our foremothers' time, it was advantageous to our survival. We only care for each other because we were interested in the survival of the group, because we realised at some level. We didn't even need to realise. It just so happened that if the group survives, then the individuals survive. all our altruism is a kind of an illusion, and that really essentially it was all about survival. And do you see the logic of it? It's quite strong. And Maturana, the whole point of this is it's not essentially about language. This.
But if it's strong, and if it stands the case that altruism is a good mechanism for survival, then doesn't that kind of laugh in the face of people who say that selfishness is the root for true survival, and being ruthless is good for survival if being altruistic is actually...
Yeah, no, but it just reminds me of, you know, this is some horrible meetings at the university, you know, where basically the department's under threat, you know, because if we don't get enough students, then we're going to have to sack somebody, which is essentially you're going to die, but in you know, corporate terms, you know, this is how the university goes. So we all have to now come together and form a group in order to survive. And just to give you a background, whereas previously we just cooperated together, we were just colleagues. We weren't surviving. We weren't under threat. We had government quotas of the number of students that we were going to get, and we were just enjoying being together and working together. You know, but where the evolutionary idea is of that kind of altruism. We all club together, because we were threatened by, you know, and that the only reason that we're kind to each other at all is because we're worried about our survival. That, because the theory of evolution is a kind of an answer, a deep answer, to why we have, why we behave the way we do. And if it's all going to have to be explained mechanistically, then it all has to be explained in terms of survival of the fittest. So there's a whole social biology, a whole sociology, a social biology that is essentially says, the only explanatory principle we have for all of human behaviour is survival of the fittest. And Maturana wants, in a way, to say that comes out of this reductionistic thinking. And that if you think, if you take a systems view of things, then evolution starts to look different. You start to have a different understanding of what evolution is about, which is just, you know, emerging. I was in part of this enormous introduction. It's emerging because the Human Genome Project is a total failure. You know, there's about five genes that actually code for a disease. You know, Huntington's. There's only five. All other human diseases are effects of the interaction of these complex systems, and that the process of the evolution of life on Earth was not a process of DNA being changed. Of course, DNA did change, but it's not. You remember Dawkins' book? You probably don't, but the Selfish Gene. That book said, we think that we're in charge. No, we're just we're hosts,
carriers
of our genetic material. It's the genetic material that is everything. That's what, you know, reductionism produces, that picture, and that picture is deeply attuned to corporate capitalism.
Find what they want to find, and then project that, and
barely
see that.
But in order, in a way, to take back our... That's taken something from us, right? How do you respond to it? You can't say that neo-Darwinistic biology is rubbish. Right? You have to have an intelligent response to it. I'm giving you Maturana because he is an intelligent response to that view. And in part two of the lecture, I would like to explain that. Yes?
Can we go to the
yes.
Let's turn that on. Biology takes on.